The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We've been talking a lot about Germany on this show, about the migrant crisis, about the election crisis, about what's going on within German politics. Well, today I want to talk to you about something else you really need to watch for in Germany, in Europe, in the United States. Something that's going to be absolutely transformational for all of these powers. And that is a building financial crisis in the United States. This is something that a lot of experts are talking about at the moment. We've seen a lot of headlines on this. It's something that's really going to affect Europe. This is something that Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about years ago, about how an American financial crisis would affect Europe. And there are now headlines and articles in the newspapers saying almost exactly that. We'll start with, in the first half, talking about the building crisis in America and the U.S. economy. And then after that, we'll transition and talk about why you need to watch Germany and how they respond to this crisis. Now, we can be almost certain that there's going to be a recession in the U.S. very soon. Very little doubt about that. The longest the U.S. has ever gone without a recession is 10 years. Now, the last recession was 8 years ago. So it's very unlikely that America is going to be able to set a brand new record for the longest it's gone without a recession. It seems like it's going to happen. And there's been a lot of news about this. Some of this we've read before on this show. Quite a bit of it is new. So a bit of review, but we'll gather it all together and look at what's happening in the U.S. economy right now. The first piece I'll read a few quotes from is from Jacob Shapiro in Geopolitical Futures. And I think this is from about the middle of November. And it's titled, Why the next U.S. recession could be worse than the last. He writes, for all the optimism surrounding low unemployment rates and record high median income, there are some signs that something is rotten in the U.S. economy. This isn't wholly surprising. Economic health tends to be cyclical and the U.S. is due for a recession. Like I said, it'd be record-breaking if they don't have one in the next couple of years. But when the next recession comes, there's a reason to believe it won't be business as usual. The structural problems that led to the 2008 financial crisis haven't been fixed. If anything, they've got worse. So we're not just looking at a run-of-the-mill crisis. We're looking at just an exceptional financial crisis building. He points to a number of factors. We'll go through some of those factors now. We'll quote him a bit more later and some others. Now, one big factor in this building crisis is an explosion in household debt. Earlier this year, America reached an ominous milestone where the level of household debt rose to higher than it had been before the 2008 financial crisis. That was a crisis caused by debt. Now household debt is more than that. More recently, we're getting close, very close now, to a new milestone, passing $13 trillion in household debt for the first time ever. That would be a new record. But here's a clip just from a local news station from that time in around May, where America's household debt surpassed what it had been before the 2008 financial crisis.
Time now for Eyewitness News. Call 12 for action. Americans are facing record-breaking consumer debt.
We owe $12.7 trillion on our mortgages, car loans, student loans, and credit cards. Eyewitness News consumer reporter Susan Campbell joins us now to break it all down.
Kelly and Mike, the previous consumer debt peak happened during the recession in 2008. We just shattered that record by $50 billion.
Americans have debt, a lot of debt, $12.73 trillion worth of debt.
It's the highest ever.
According to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, about 71% of our debt is for mortgages or home equity loans, 10.6% for student loans, 9.2% for auto loans, and 6% nearly $800 billion for credit cards.
Credit card debt is going up partly because the economy is doing pretty well and people feel better. And when consumer confidence is high, they go and spend.
So that debt is rising up, blasting past records. And I said that was from May. So it's something we've come well beyond now. Jacob Shapiro wrote about this in his article. He wrote, household debt in the United States is now almost $13 trillion. The figure exceeds total household debt at any point during or in the recovery period after the 2008 financial crisis. Housing debt has crept back up to pre-2008 levels. Credit card debt has reached pre-2008 levels too. Student loan debt has skyrocketed by 134% since the first quarter of 2008. About 9% on average. And one major shift, you heard the breakdown there about where these different debts come from in that clip. But one of the big shifts is that more and more of this debt is becoming unsecured. So before the financial crisis, a much larger proportion of this was household debt, mortgage debt. And that was a big problem. House prices were overinflated. But if you can't pay your mortgage, they're still your house, and the bank has some kind of asset at the end of the day if you default on your mortgage. With these other debts, with things like student loan debts or credit card debt, there's not really any asset at the end of the day. And things you like auto loan debt, well, yes, there's a car, but often that car depreciates much more quickly than the loans get paid off. And so there's not an asset of anywhere close to the value of the loan that can be repossessed. That makes these debts often more risky, a potential danger. Here's how Daniele DiMartino Booth, a former advisor to the Dallas Fed and author of a book called Fed Up, explains what this means for the U.S. economy. And again, this was from a few months ago when the U.S. passed that debt milestone.
Well, at the same time, household borrowing appears to be more sustainable, according to some analysts. They cite lower interest rates, and a more tough look at creditworthy borrowers. Would you agree with that, that people just aren't being handed out as much? They may be seeking it, but not getting it.
You know, I'm going to have to push back on that. I think that is the conventional wisdom. But the fact is, Americans have not been able to access mortgage debt, but they've had to offset that with unsecured borrowing, where the lending standards are much looser. And so we've seen skyrocketing levels of student debt, $1.4 trillion. The auto sector is now over $1 trillion. You know that when you drive that car off the lot, that it depreciates very quickly. And we've seen an increase in credit card lending as well, in order to make up for what Americans used to pull out of their homes in the form of cash out refinancings. But again, this is unsecured debt that they've been taking on that's easier to get their hands on than mortgages, and so they've done so.
So you're seeing this shift into unsecured debt. John Maudlin talked about this as well in an article he published, 8 charts that show how insane the economy is today. Again, this is from 1 or 2 weeks ago. He wrote that taxpayers are on the hook for over $1 trillion in student debt. Unlike mortgage or business debt, student debt is backed by no tangible asset you can repossess. It bought knowledge that now hopefully resides in the student's brain, but it may have just gone in one ear and out the other. That makes this debt uniquely risky. And as taxpayers, he writes, you and I are taking the risk, like it or not. Another headline on debt last week. This is from the New York Post. Americans' household debt has surged by $605 billion this year. They write, the huge surge in total U.S. household debt, now at a record $12.96 trillion, and a harbinger of recession, some analysts say, is washing across New York with brutal consequences. From extended lines of cash-strapped consumers at New York food pantries to a rise in mental health problems, the latest New York Quarterly Fed data paints a dire picture. U.S. household debt has grown by $605 billion in the past 12 months, with $116 billion, or nearly 1%, hitting in the last quarter. Debt is mushrooming everywhere on mortgages, student loans, auto loans. Credit card debt, meanwhile, has jumped by 3.1% in the last quarter. This article goes on to talk about how food pantries are having to turn hungry people away because there's more demand for limited emergency food stock. It writes, one expert says the credit card binge reminds him of the build-up to the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. And this, say other experts, could be the telltale signs of an imminent recession. As lenders continue to ratchet up their profiles, the Fed data shows an increase in credit cards and auto loans moving into delinquency. Many credit card consumers have already given up the ghost or have had lenders call them for overdue payments. However, there are more than enough credit card victims to take up the slack. He quotes Kevin Galagos, a senior vice president at Freedom Debt Relief, who says, I would say this is very similar to what I saw 10 years ago. People are using their credit cards quite a bit. This article continues, back then, when total household debt was heading towards a peak of $12.68 trillion, which ended in disaster, debt-burdened consumers were addicted to cards, often those offering a tantalizing 0% monthly interest rate for as long as 12 months or more. That strategy, now back in vogue, often ends in tears as the debt piles up. By the time the consumers move their balances to the fourth card at 0%, companies eventually cut them off for the next card, said Galagos. The fallout can be dreadful. We've had clients telling us they're on the verge of suicide, their marriages are breaking up, or I don't have enough food to put on my table, said Galagos. We hear sad stories all the time. And this isn't something that's just affecting the US. We have an article on our website at the moment. Canadians lead the world in household debt by our very own Mr. Schlote there up in Canada, writing on what's happening here, what's happening up there. He writes, an upcoming report from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development has some blistering news for Canadians. They're leading the world in household debt. In a chapter released in advance of next month's report, the OECD calculated the household debt levels compared to the size of the overall economy in 28 nations. They found that the ratio between household debt and gross domestic product in Canada was higher than in any other country studied. The result showed that Canada's household debt equaled 101% of the country's GDP. So more household debt than the entire Canadian economy produces in a year. South Korea and Britain took the runner-up position, with household debt equating just over 80% of GDP. He also notes that Statistics Canada found that the debt-to-income ratio was now at 167.8%. So it means, on average, Canadians owe $1.68 for every dollar they earn. And then some of the stats he pulls out from other, from opinion polls and things like that are just shocking. He talks about a survey from October where 42% of Canadians said they couldn't cover, they didn't think they could cover basic expenses over the next year without debt. 42%, that's nearly half. Another one, one in four Canadian homeowners agreed that they were in over their heads with their current mortgage payments. One in four. And this is at an era of record low interest rates. It wouldn't be hard at all for interest rates to even double. He quotes economists Catherine Mann and Filippo Gori, writing, while higher indebtedness does not necessarily imply that problems are just around the corner, it does increase vulnerability to shocks. The reports also found that Canada's house prices are 50% higher than they normally or than they should be. So, and then the report says research points to a number of links between high indebtedness and the risk of severe recession. So that's just one example from Canada. You've got the same kind of thing going on in the UK with massive debt. Going back to this article by Jacob Shapiro, he also talked about how there's the beginnings of signs now that more and more people are defaulting on their debt or failing to pay their credit card debt back. He wrote that it's still a relatively small percent, but it started to become an increasing percent. Now banks like JP Morgan and Chase are having to put more money aside for their reserves to cover losses on these types of loans to consumers. So they're setting money aside to use later because they're expecting more of their consumers to not pay back those loans. And that had an impact on their share price. J.P. Shapiro writes, put simply, American consumers are beginning to spend beyond their means. And this is a big deal when it comes to predicting recessions or financial crises. I have a book here called This Time is Different, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly by Carmen M. Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff. And these two, Reinhart and Rogoff, they've collaborated on quite a few different things, but they have a data-driven analysis of financial crises over several hundreds of years. And they write, if there is one common theme to the vast range of crises we consider in this book, it is that excessive debt accumulation, whether it be like by the government, banks, corporations, or consumers, often poses greater systemic risks than it seems during a boom. Infusions of cash can make a government look like it's providing greater growth to its economy than it really is. Private sector borrowing binges can inflate housing and stock prices far beyond their long-run sustainable levels and make banks seem more stable and profitable than they really are. Such large-scale debt build-ups pose risks because they make an economy vulnerable to crises of confidence, particularly when the debt is short-term and needs to constantly be refinanced. Debt-fueled booms all too often provide false affirmation of a government's policies, a financial institution's ability to make outsized profits, or a country's standard of living. Most of these booms end badly. And we'll talk more about the boom in the stock market that we're experiencing, but most of these booms end badly. Now, there's another important indicator that a lot of people are talking about, as I've started talking about a lot in the last few weeks. It's something that can sound a little technical. It isn't really, but it can sound that way when not fully explained. And that is a flattening yield curve. And this comes up a lot, as I said, in articles that talk about a coming recession. And what this means, this is about the difference in the interest rates on short-term and long-term treasury bonds. So when the US government is trying to persuade people to lend them money, usually if they're going to try and persuade people to lend them money over a long period of time, they have to offer more interest rate or more interest than they would trying to persuade people to lend them money over a short period of time, which makes sense. If you're going to have your money locked up and you're not going to be able to access it for the next 10 years, say, because you've lent it to the US government, well, you're going to want to be rewarded much more than if you had it, your money was only going to be lent to the US government for 1 year. Now, what a flattening yield curve means is that there becomes much less of a difference in the interest the government has to pay in persuading people to lend them money for a longer period of time. So the amount of interest they'd have to offer to persuade you to lend them money for, say, the next 10 years isn't any more as big as it is for short-term loans. Now, one big reason this happens is if investors think that the short-term picture looks bad. If they think that there's a recession in the near future, well, then they're going to be looking for somewhere safe to put their money, somewhere where they're going to be confident that they're not going to lose it. And they're willing to tolerate low returns, not getting much money back, because at least it's safe. And US treasuries are considered very safe. The US hasn't defaulted on its treasuries. It hasn't refused to pay the debt back since the days of Alexander Hamilton, apart from a small incident in 1979. But that's a pretty good track record. And so when times are uncertain and people are afraid that investing in other things like the stock market or property could end up with them losing money, well, they'll put that into long-term treasuries to make sure at least that money is safe. When that happens, you get a flatter yield curve. The US government doesn't have to offer as high of an interest rate to tempt buyers to come and lend them money. And that's what we're seeing right now. Geopolitical Futures had an article again over the last few weeks, a US recession, will economic change mean political change? And they write, investors are now flocking to long-term treasuries to reduce risk, a sign that they believe the economy will fare poorly in the future. After 2008, when the Fed lowered interest rates, stocks and junk bonds with low credit rating and high interest rates, were purchased in greater numbers. Now, it talks about how now pension funds and these kind of things are getting rid of what they think are risky assets and investing in things that are meant to be not risky, like US treasuries, which is just a classic sign that people believe tough times are ahead. So you're seeing a lot of people across the market, at least when it comes to US debt, expecting these tough times. Now, another reason that we're probably heading into a recession is you're seeing a massive stock market bubble. Again, quoting from this article from Maudlin Economics, 8 charts that show how insane the economy is today. It writes, or it's Maudlin Economics, I guess, but it writes, this U.S. stock market as a percentage of GDP is now far bigger than it was at the housing bubble's peak, and it's rapidly approaching the dot-com bubble peak. That ought to make us a little nervous when we watch the Dow hit new all-time highs. And Mr. Trump kind of talks about this a lot as if it's a great thing, that it's a sign that the U.S. economy is doing really well. When the Dow Jones is reaching massive heights that are all out of proportion of what's really going on in the economy, actually that's usually a sign that it's about to burst, that there's a bubble, that you're about to see a massive collapse in stock prices. Maudlin, in this article, goes on to talk about how the market just appears to be behaving irrationally at the moment. It's not responding to all the bad news that we see around it. It says the market is ignoring the continued North Korea threat, the disturbing Kabuki theater in Washington. It goes on to talk about the division in the government and this kind of thing. It's ignoring reduced domestic GDP growth expectations and, by implication, reduced profit expectations as it rallied nearly 1% on Tuesday. So there's all these things going on that normally would make stock markets fall, but it just keeps getting higher and higher. Citigroup Research, they wrote, there seemed to be a growing fear among a number of central bankers that we have spoken to recently. In our experience, they too are somewhat baffled by the lack of response to negative headlines. Business Insider, they had a report on a major fund manager, Neil Woodford. This is from an article titled, "There are so many lights flashing red. Fund manager Neil Woodford warns of a stock market bubble." They write, "Star British fund manager has warned stock markets around the world are in a bubble, which could result in one of the worst market crashes in history." Speaking to the Financial Times, Woodford said, "Whether it's Bitcoin going through $10,000, European junk bonds yielding less than US treasuries, historic low levels of volatility, or triple leveraged exchange rate traded funds attracting giant inflows, there are so many lights flashing red that I am losing count." So it really looks like we're heading for this recession. He said, going back to this article, he said he currently equity valuations represent a bubble the likes of which he had, quote, "only witnessed 2 or 3 times in my career as an investor." So everything seems poised for a recession, for a crash. But then, you know, there are crashes and there are crashes. Which one is this? Is this going to be kind of a garden variety recession or something much, much worse? Well, as we quoted even right at the start from that article from Geopolitical Futures, there are a lot of indications that we're not just seeing a build-up to, say, an every 10-year recession. There's a lot of figures that make it look like this is going to be transformationally bad. Going back to this article from Jacob Shapiro, he talks about just the much longer-term problems facing American consumers and earners. He writes, "The U.S. economy may have recovered in terms of top-line figures, but middle- and lower-income families have not. For those hardest hit, the tales of recovery ring hollow." He talks about how in the 1950s, you know, the median cost of a home was about double a family's average income, and a car was about half a family's average income. Now, it's about 4 times a family's average income. It's about 2/3 its average income to buy a car. He writes, "The purchasing power of the real median income has decreased, even as U.S. households have added a second breadwinner to a home. The American dream was never about just making ends meet. It was about social mobility and giving your children a better life than you had growing up. That is beyond the means of an increasing number of U.S. households. When the next recession comes, it will come as inequality reaches new heights. And if U.S. history is any indication, that will translate into massive political change." And look at the division we already have in the United States right now. And that kind of division would only get much worse in the wake of an economic crisis. So there's a lot pointing to even a crisis setting off increased social unrest in the United States. And then when you come back to America's overall debt levels, you know, we've talked about consumer debt. There's also massive government debt, corporation debt, debt in so many different ways. And America's repeatedly avoided dealing with the consequences of this debt. Each time there's been a recession where they've managed to kind of muddle through it without this massive debt causing massive problems. But they can't do this forever. And that debt has just exploded since in the last 20 years or so. Mr. Robert Morley, had an article in the Trumpet magazine, I think it's the February one from this year. And he writes, depending on how you calculate it, America has liabilities of greater than $100 trillion. Boston University's Lawrence Kotloff said it is closer to $200 trillion. That's a potential debt storm so big it is virtually impossible to fathom. Forget those promises made because they won't be paid. Not in full. This is going to hurt a lot of people who are relying on the government for shelter during retirement. But even the part of the debt that analysts think the government could pay is quickly blowing past America's ability to sustain it. The total size of the US economy is under $18 trillion, which equates to a government debt-to-GDP ratio of over 110%. That's up from over 100% of gross domestic product in 2011. Just 8 years ago, the federal debt was $10 trillion. This has almost doubled during the tenure of America's current president. And it doubled during the previous administration, too. Is that rate of growth sustainable? Can America keep doubling its debt every different administration? Absolutely not. But then Mr. Morley writes, does that mean politicians will come to their senses, that the debt storm will abet? No. In fact, the total debt storm will probably intensify before making landfall. Today, U.S. household debt hit a whopping $12.25 trillion last March, and we talked about how it's now well beyond what it is on the 2008 mortgage crisis. So that debt is building in so many other ways, and there's got to be a reckoning for that. We didn't see that reckoning in the 2008 financial crisis. It's something America came very, very close to, but didn't happen. That's almost certainly got to happen this time round. Another factor we talked about on this show quite a few weeks back is weakening in U.S. allies. I won't go into too much detail as we have covered that before, but part of the reason some economists are talking about or saying, well, the reason why America hasn't so far lost its status as the world's reserve currency and just as a central economy and been able to keep borrowing money is its allies. That these allies, because they were U.S. allies, keep investing in U.S. debt and keep buying dollars. But those alliances are now fraying. So with America losing those allies, well, are those allies going to keep propping up the American economy? And the answer that this economist at least came to was almost certainly not. And then finally, America used all its ammunition that it had to deal with crises back in 2008, and it's not been replenished. You know, the U.S. debt exploded to deal with the fallout of that crisis. It slashed interest rates. It printed money. The idea is you take all of these measures when times are bad, and then when things get better, you know, you replenish that. You raise interest rates so you can lower them again. Next time a recession hits, you pay off that debt so you can borrow again. Next time a recession hits, and that's the theory. What's happened in practice is, well, it hasn't happened in practice. All that debt is still out there. It's not been repaid. The interest rates are still very near record lows. I know the US or the UK raised theirs by 0.25% recently. I'm not sure if the Fed has done anything similar, but certainly very close to record lows. So there's no room to cut next time a financial crisis hits. There's very little room for borrowing. All that borrowing has already happened. So how can America deal with the next crisis? We came very close to a hugely destructive financial crisis in 2008, and we've changed nothing after that. Here's how Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory talked about what happened back in 2008 in a clip a couple of years ago in a Key of David program.
Many experts said that the financial crisis in America was within hours of wrecking the economy. Now, I'm sure there'll be people that disagree with that, but nevertheless, you have to admit that it was a scary, frightening specter that we saw at that time. What was going on? How serious is it? Well, maybe we ought to take a look at what's happening in Greece today and take another look at this. But did we take any kind of radical action to correct this problem and to make it or to solve it? Well, no. The debt is soaring, and growing worse every day to the tune of $3 billion. What do you think about that? I mean, you just ask almost any authority, or many of them anyhow will tell you a worse crisis is coming.
A worse crisis is coming, and America's not taken the radical action necessary to deal with it since that 2008 crisis. This coming crisis is something that ties in very strongly with some vital Bible prophecies, very significant outcomes of this crisis that tie directly into prophecy. And that's what we'll talk about when we get back from the break.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've been talking about the financial crisis coming soon to the United States, how the longest the United States has ever gone without a recession is 10 years. We've not had one for 8 years, so another one is just around the corner. We've talked about how that's building the massive levels of debt, how there's this growing expectation in Treasury bond yields, or that's indicated by Treasury bond yields, that we're coming to a crisis. But now I want to talk about a major and vitally important outcome of this crisis, and that comes from Germany. In 1968, Mr. Armstrong, he discussed in a letter the economic crisis that would eventually come to the United States and Britain. He wrote that if the dollar is devalued, inflation will almost result in eventual economic collapse for the United States. He talked about prophecies such as the prophecies in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And he wrote, "Those of you who truly believe the prophecies of your Bible know such an economic collapse is prophesied to happen. We have shown how God prophesies a virtual trade war will get underway against the United States and Britain and how our national economies will falter and collapse." In 1984, he talked about how a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. That in turn could bring on the Great Tribulation suddenly. And we'll hear a clip towards the end of this section where Mr. Armstrong talked about that. But he was saying that, you know, there'll be an economic crisis, so watch Europe. Watch Germany. Watch how these powers respond. An economic collapse in the United States is going to have a profound impact on Europe and on Germany. Now, we saw some of that already in the financial crisis of 2008. That's something that had a major impact on Europe that really changed in a lot of ways just how Europe and the European Union works. We're seeing a lot of that building now. But remember that statement from Mr. Armstrong. And then here's a headline from a couple of weeks ago. George Friedman, a U.S. recession is imminent, so watch Germany. This was an article about a conference at Berlin. It was the 2017 CFA Institute European Investment Conference. And that article included the full video of that talk. So I thought I'd share some of the clips with you, seeing as, you know, that's a headline that comes right out of Bible prophecy, right out of what Mr. Armstrong was saying. And he has some excellent insight there. So we'll hear now just a clip from towards the start of that that talk he gave at the CFA Institute European Investment Conference.
And this is the thing to remember, and it's a crucial thing to bear in mind, that the most important consequences of financial crises are political. Yes, it costs you money and you lose things, but what happens is that in these financial crises, the way works changes. Europe was built on the principle of peace and prosperity. In 2008, they lost prosperity in two ways. Member nations like Southern Europe had a very different outcome than Northern Europe. And not everybody in every country enjoyed the same outcome.
So, economic crises have political consequences. We saw the major political consequences in 2008. And as we see this financial crisis building, we need to watch for political consequences in Europe. So with that in mind, I'll read just a few or another headline or two from newspaper articles. Well, first I'll just mention we have that issue of the latest Trumpet print edition talking about the rise of strongmen in Europe. And think about a lot of these strongmen have come about because of economics, because of political responses to economic crises. You had the economic crisis in Eastern Europe, and that has played a key role in the rise of those strongmen there. Even Xi Jinping in China, I suspect a big part of the reason why he's been allowed to become a strongman in China is because the other members of the Communist Party and the Politburo and that kind of thing believe that China needs a strong leader to navigate some of its coming economic problems. So Ambrose Evans Pritchard, this is from The Telegraph a few months ago, Germany risks boom-bust havoc as zero-rate cause overheating. So he writes, Germany is speeding far above its safe economic limit thanks to the wrong monetary policy. Germany is on the cusp of serious overheating and risks lasting damage to its unique economic model, prompting demands for a drastic change of course by the European Central Bank. He quotes Professor Clemens Fuest, head of the IFO Institute, saying, the German economy is on track for a boom. He says, there is the danger of a real estate bubble in the bigger cities, and it is not going to stop. The lesson of the past is that the longer this momentum goes on, the more dangerous it becomes. And I see a lot of dangers. He quotes Professor Richard Werner, a German economist from Southampton University, saying, we are going to have a massive misallocation of resources and a property bubble just like Japan in the late 1980s. The negative interest rate policy and bond purchases are disastrous. So this article is talking about how the low interest rates of the European Central Bank are setting Germany up for a boom and bust, that it's just like the stock market in America. It's going through an unsustainable boom and that a bust is coming. But the real danger to the German economy here comes from, just like Mr. Armstrong talked about, a financial crisis in America, a knock-on effect from that American financial crisis. And if that happens, that's really going to hit Germany. Here's another clip from Friedman from that conference on how that can happen.
Well, we come now to the final dilemma, the final problem of this story, which has been told so many times in history. The last and most dangerous piece of the puzzle, Germany. Germany exports 50% of its GDP. In other words, the fourth largest economy in the world and the largest in Europe is absolutely dependent on its customers' ability to buy. Germany does not control its future. Germany assumes that there will not be financial crisis that reduce the ability of others to buy their products. A 5% decline in exports is a 2.5% decline in GDP.
So Germany's very vulnerable to what happens in America. And he called it the last and most dangerous piece of the puzzle. When you're looking at financial crises, when you're looking at what's going on in America, well, the most dangerous piece of the puzzle is what happens to Germany. And yeah, there's a lot of dangers from a financial crisis in America, but that's an excellent point. And it's something that doesn't just affect Germany. Anything that happens in Germany is going to spread to the rest of Europe. Here's another clip from that talk there.
At what point does the German GDP begin to contract because of insufficient exports? And as Germany contracts, so does the Czech Republic, so does Romania, so does the Netherlands. So this is the final shoe to drop from 2008. And that shoe is the country that is most dependent on exports, major country, that is most hostage to its customers, many of which are already crippled by the trading crisis. And now the last one standing, the United States, is moving to it.
So if Germany, you know, Germany's the economic heart of Europe. It's the economic engine of Europe. If they get into trouble, well, that's an economic crisis for all of Europe. And like Friedman said in that first clip, this goes beyond monetary consequences. This isn't just about people's income. It is about politics as well. So we need to watch Germany here. Here's how Friedman describes what is at stake there.
The system malfunctioned institutionally in 2008. That we did not have a financial crisis, we had an institutional crisis. That we took the fire breaks out of the system. And we had this. And we've been living with this consequence. China has suffered from the consequence. Saudi Arabia suffers from the consequence. Russia has suffered. Germany has managed to dodge the bullet. And from a global point of view, my eyes at least, if not everyone's eyes, are on Germany. How does it navigate the next few years? How does it navigate an American recession? How does it sustain exports? And if it can't sustain exports, how will it politically manage the contraction in GDP and the inevitable unemployment that follows? I haven't got the answer to that. You have the answer to that. But this group needs to really look at the fact that there is one last piece of the puzzle before we can move on. We have to wait for Germany to make its move. It's not the first time in history. Won't be the last, but this is the problem that we face now.
So we're waiting for Germany. My eyes are on Germany, he said. This is where we've got to. This is where we've got to watch. This is one of the most important places to watch in the world. If there's a financial crisis, watch Germany, just like Mr. Armstrong was saying. So that was around the end of his talk. And then after that, there was a question and answer session. There were a couple of very interesting points he made there. So I just want to play a couple of bits from that as well. So here's from the start of that question and answer and the first question.
Well, we have a number of great questions from the audience. First, thank you very much for this presentation. Despite its dismal outlook for Germany, you said as early as 2 years ago that Germany is a vulnerable, insecure country in a bubble that could pop any time. Given what you said now, I mean, can you somehow say what would happen once it popped?
Well, I mean, it would pop in the same way it popped in other countries that are exporters. Right now, Germany has a very low growth rate that is better than it's been, so it's very happy. If exports drop by 10%, you're peeling a very large amount off the German GDP. Depending on what industries are unable to export as much, they either continue hiring these people, their workers, or they lay them off. If they lay them off, this is more fuel for the right-wing parties that have emerged. This is the same as other countries. So the most important effect is not only the financial effect, but the political effect. Because at that point, the question of whether or not this established political establishment knows how to manage a financial crisis, you will be in the same position as the United States. People who have never been politicians before will have more credibility than those who have been politicians for 10 years.
So without any need to personalize it, I mean, you will have what many countries have had, a social crisis. And Germany has not had this sort of social crisis since 1991 and the integration.
So a social crisis. This is where Germany is heading right now. And you know, he talks about how it's pushing to the rise of the far right. The alternative for Deutschland is already on 13-14%. If the current coalition that they're talking about goes ahead, they'll be the main opposition party. They'll be the ones that will have the first response every time Angela Merkel gives a speech, every time the government's discussing legislation. Well, they're the main opposition party, the biggest opposition party. They get to speak first. And this is before this kind of economic crisis has hit the United States. You can really see how this could be a social, a political earthquake within Germany once this hits. And how, as he talks about, well, they're going to be looking for people who've not been in politics for the last 10 years. People who have been out of politics. Never politicians before, or maybe just gone from the scene for a while. They're going to be the ones that are the more credible ones, the ones people are turning to. There's one final interesting question that you heard, as he said, well, this would be a social crisis that Germany hasn't seen anything like since 1991. Well, here he's asked, well, what is the biggest, you know, what is the best time period to compare this to? And listen to his answer.
Maybe the one question refers to exactly that situation. It says, given that it's never different this time, is there a period in history we can look to in analyzing what is going on?
Well, I think the best period to look at in terms of what's going on, but I don't think it's this intense, is the period of the late 1920s, early 1930s, when the trading system collapsed, again, primarily because Germany was destroyed in the war, couldn't import, and the political system failed to respond rationally. In other words, instead of attempting to adjust the international trading system, it compounded the problem, the United States in particular, by tariffs. What you had at that point was a systemic failure of the global economy, particularly the European and the American.
So, you know, he goes on to talk about, he kind of reinforces what he said at the start about, I don't think it's as intense as the 1920s, 1930s. But if someone's saying, well, what's the best time period to compare Germany to? Well, Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, or Germany late 20s, early 30s, that's a pretty terrifying time period to bring up. Say, well, you know, the best parallel that we can draw to look at is Germany before, or Germany while Adolf Hitler was rising. Germany before it started World War II. That's the best time period. That's a pretty shocking statement. As I said, he did play some of that down a little, but and that's a big deal. If anything, he was probably less optimistic in his book Flashpoints. This was out a few years ago, but he says there, the question of Europe is now again the question of Germany, of what it wants, what it fears, what it will and won't do. This is the old question of Europe, and it goes along with the oldest question of Europe. When will the next war start and where will it be fought? He talks about how Germany is united and unquestionably the leading power of Europe. And in this book, he talks more about the consequences to Germany of a European-wide financial crisis. But we've already talked about how any downturn in the U.S., a recession in the U.S. becomes a German financial crisis, and then that spreads to all of Europe. And even if Germany is suffering with high unemployment and this kind of thing, well, its government is still much more wealthy than other nations like Greece, etc. And so if this happens, if you have an economic crisis in Europe, he talks about how European countries are going to be trying to get their hands on German money more and more. And he writes, Germany will have a choice of accepting the punishment or using its vast resources to transform wealth into power. Nations do not become strong because they feel like it, but because they must. Germany will face stark choices, and increasing its strength in all dimensions will become more bearable than the alternative. Germany will therefore become a fully fledged power, flexing its political muscles and at times its military ones as pressures develop. So economic downturns, they force these hard choices on Germany. So those are some very powerful warnings. Now, as I mentioned at the start, this is something that comes right from what Mr. Armstrong was saying. I read a few quotes from him and from the Plain Truth magazine. We'll listen to just a short clip where he talks about this as well.
And in the days of these kings, those toes which represent a nation to be formed, as I told you, in Europe when they go together. Now they're trying to form that now, and this economic crisis may be the thing that'll plunge them into it.
So this economic crisis, well, that could be the thing that plunges them into that helps them unite. This is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Furrier has also talked about. Here's a clip again from that Key of David program a couple of years ago, but just talking about how closely connected America is to Europe. And when you have an American financial crisis, well, watch Europe. And he reads some of those quotes from Mr. Armstrong and adds some comments. So we'll listen to that clip. That's clip 9 now.
But just how is the, or let's say, how are the 10 nations going to unite in Europe politically? Well, the United States is going to play a key role in that in a negative way and help them to unite in a way that was actually predicted by Herbert Armstrong many years ago. It is going to become a strong political and military power. And I want to talk to you today about the American-Europe financial crisis. The two units are tied together. The two entities are tied together. Here's something that Herbert Armstrong wrote in 1984. He wrote about the massive banking crisis in America. Quote, it could suddenly result in triggering a European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the U.S. Now, that is a lot of power. And he explained how the European banks and all of these American banks are tied very closely together. It ties together one financial structure, one financial unit, you could say, and in a way includes much of the global world because it's such a powerful force. But Mr. Armstrong predicted years ago that financial crisis would cause these 10 nations to be united that people had tried so hard to unite up to that point and could not. And even to this point, they haven't been able to do it the way they want to. But it's really beginning to move fast in that direction, and it's going to shock this world when that great superpower bursts on the scene. You're going to see that happen in your lifetime, and I mean very, very soon. There's already a financial crisis in action in America and in Europe, and they're closely tied together, which is what maybe a lot of people do not understand. The European Union.
And a lot of that's exactly what Friedman was talking about, how closely tied together all of this is. But these forecasts, they make a lot of sense in light of Bible prophecy. There are a lot of prophecies in your Bible that have a strong economic component to them, that talk about, and there are prophecies that talk about the rise of Europe as an economic power. They talk about the fall of the United States with its economy. It talks about a siege on the United States, for example, in Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, Ezekiel 4 and 5. You know, a siege, that's a trade embargo. People refusing to trade with the United States. Revelation 18 talks about this new European power and talks about it being incredibly populous, prosperous at the head of a new economic system. It talks about how the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through this power. Isaiah 23 talks about this European power forming a mart of nations, a trade relationship with those kings of the East, with China, with Japan. So it's a major trading power. So this is talking about a massive economic shift, a global economy that no longer revolves around the US, but around Europe. And an economic collapse in the United States could bring that about. The US goes down, there's a social crisis in Germany, you see the strongman trend hit Germany. And then you You know, Germany, despite its immediate financial problems, is still a manufacturing superpower. It's been hoarding gold, so they can come right back with a new trading system, with a united Europe. Now, that trading system without the U.S. is pretty bleak. Now, they bring the U.S. down, and Revelation 18 talks about this power trading in slaves. But notice where this is leading. We played that clip from Mr. Armstrong earlier, and here's how he finished that same clip.
And in the days of these kings, those toes which represent a nation to be formed, as I told you, in Europe when they go together. Now they're trying to form that now, and this economic crisis may be the thing that'll plunge them into it. And in the days of these kings, that's the ones that maybe will rise up in the next year or two or three, or whatever. Shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom? In their days, God will set up a kingdom, which will be, of course, the kingdom of God, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. That's the kingdoms that will be in Europe and that are on the earth today. And it shall stand forever.
So those same prophecies that talk about this new economic power talk about how Jesus Christ is going to return and be the one that defeats that power. It leads to his return. And if you'd like for more about this, we have a chapter in our free booklet, He Who Is Right. We'll ship that to you for free. You can read it online for free. That chapter is America's Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied. And it goes into this in a lot of detail. We've got more on our website about that. That's about it from me. But please tune in next time on 101.3 on the FM dial. You can email us at TD at kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening.